Good morning and welcome to this January 27th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access our podcast later in the show. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors not only about their books, but about the writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that separate those of us from those of us who write from those of us who want to publish. So Facebook takes some well-deserved heat in the world for being, you know, kind of a time sink or banal or self-indulgent, lots of other things. But one thing it does really well, especially for writers, and this is a little tip for writers, is to bring people together with, you know, similar interests who otherwise wouldn't have gotten together. I have met so many, most of my friends on Facebook are authors, writers, publishers, and there is a wealth of information on Facebook about literary events and workshops and summer programs and MFA programs. And so I think Facebook can be a really wonderful tool for writers to use. And that is sort of how this show happened this morning. My second guest this morning is Michael Chizniewski. He's a professor at Missouri State. He's a short story fanatic like I am. And he had started a wonderful blog called Story 366, where he reviews a new short story every day of 2016. And one of his first stories was a story by Gene Thompson, who I've been a fan of for years and years and who I love. And so I commented. I think it was her birthday. He put her short story up. So I commented and he said, you know, I'm friends with Gene. Do you want to have her on the show? And so that's what we're doing this morning. Jean so graciously said she'd come on. And so thank you, Mark Zuckerberg, for today's show. It's my pleasure to welcome Jean Thompson. In the second half, Michael will come on, so stay tuned for that. But first, Jean. Jean Thompson is the author of six novels, among them The Humanity Project and The Year We Left Home, and six short story collections, including Who Do You Love?, a National Book Award finalist, and The Witch and Other Tales Retold. She lives in Illinois. She taught at the University of Illinois for a number of years. And it is my huge honor. Jean, welcome.
Good morning, Marie. Thank you for having me. And would I disappoint everyone if I told you I'm not on Facebook?
Well, I knew that, actually.
But I have friends who are, and they do they seem to do the heavy lifting for me. So
well,
thank you, Mike.
You don't have to be on Facebook when you have a big fan base on Facebook. So it's
it adds to my allure.
Exactly. You're too mysterious for us. So there are so many interesting intersections actually between you and Mike's work that I kind of want to get to, some fairy tale qualities and
okay. You know, did you know that Mike is an old student of mine from University of Illinois from his undergrad days?
You know, I had sort of guessed at it just by the way he was talking about it, but that's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, I'd like to say I taught him everything he knows, but you know, he would not let me get away with that. But
he taught you.
I'm very glad that he's doing so well.
85% of what he knows, maybe, right?
we can argue that percentage down, I think.
So let's, because you've been writing for so long, and I've been a fan of yours for so long, you've been publishing the 70s. And so I thought, you know, maybe we could just do a little quick retrospective of your work and kind of look across it, across the you know, across the decades, and talk kind of about what has captured your interest and retained your interest as a writer, kind of what themes you keep coming back to, what you've been churning through all of these years.
Yeah, I'm kind of stunned by that phrase, across the decades. I mean, it's accurate, but sobering. So, you may have read some of these older works more recently than I have. Maybe you could tell me what, if anything, you saw as any kind of connection or continuing notions.
Well, I like that in all of your work, the danger sort of lurks in the background. You know, it's often off screen, it's off page, but it's present and pulsing in all of these characters' lives. There's something sort of menacing and threatening beneath the surface that isn't, you know, it's articulated, but it's not the main action of the story. And then, you know, it's deeply psychological. All of these characters are very self-aware.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's probably how I go about my daily life, kind of semi-paranoid, waiting for the danger about to spring. But I think part of that is just craft, rather than beginning with, here's the monster from outer space that's landed in the front yard, there's the threat of something. I think that makes for a more interesting narrative, if there's something. This is why Hitchcock was great. We knew there was something out there. We could see it coming.
Yeah, right. The other thing I think you do so well is you reveal character through other characters. It's sort of what a character notices about the other characters in the story that reveals something about themselves that you couldn't otherwise do. You do a lot of your heavy lifting through observations of other people that I think is a really neat device.
Oh, thank you. I think that's part of a writer's toolbox, really, that how do you reveal character? Through what they do, through what we observe them doing, through what they say about themselves, through other people's observation, what other people say about them. So
yeah. Now, I've heard that you approach novels in a similar way that you approach short stories, that you kind of look at a novel as sort of a series of short stories, each chapter having to do kind of an arc of work that a short story would do.
I didn't always. To back up, I began as a short story writer. Most writers do. It's just more manageable. I mean, there are people that are naturally novelists and have a big tale to tell and need a big canvas. But I began by writing stories, and that's still my first love in a lot of ways. And then at some point, you have to tackle this thing called a novel. I'm pretty sure I didn't really know what I was doing. The first few times around, it's just, it has to be long, doesn't it? It really took me a while, I think, to get a grip on the form, assuming I have one now. And probably the technique you're talking about came through with The Year We Left Home, in which I said, I don't want a chapter that ends with... And then they pondered what time would pass before they finished pondering. I didn't want the kind of droopy open end to a segment of narrative. And I always have chapters. It's just easier for me to organize things. I think that's the book in which I hit on the notion of having each chapter have the kind of arc of a story, mm-hmm. that something would be different or accomplished by the time you reach that chapter's end, even if it suggested further action. So that was the first book in which I consciously tried to apply that. I just think it makes for I don't want to say suspense, but the kind of momentum that you would want to read in a longer work, and so that helped me a great bit. And I've written two novels since then, and have tried to apply that again. I mean, I think that was a useful revelation for me. Write them like stories, or using short story technique to approach a novel.
Well, it's really helpful because the novel just seems like such a daunting, decade-long task.
It doesn't take me decades, but, takes a while. It's a different kind of focus. Short stories are more, I won't say immediate gratification, but they're finite. You're not going to live with them for months at a time. At least I don't.
Right, right. The last collection, The Witch and Other Tales, which are based on fairy tales, I thought for writers who, like me, have difficulty with structure and plot, and I enjoy more character studies, it's nice to give yourself sort of a form to work under where you have the structure in place and then you're just able to play with character and play with psychology.
Yeah, you have a template. With the stories in The Witch, I was just fascinated with the idea of, these stories that have been around you know, forever, you know, ever since there was probably spoken language, and what and why they're with us so long, and what makes them so evergreen, and you know, the take so many forms. So it was great. It was like hitching your wagon to a very long-lasting star, and then playing with the idea of what the tales are really about, of deconstructing them in a way, and rearranging them and making them into something, you know, more contemporary and recognizable. Which all sounds very lofty, but yeah, you can apply it pretty well to, or at least I did, to some of the more well-known stories. You know, what is Little Red Riding Hood really about? Yeah. Well, maybe it's about that young girl that decides it would be fun to walk through the woods in her red coat. La 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 la. You know, oh my goodness, here's a big bad wolf. I think that there's something kind of exhibitionist about Little Red Riding Hood, which turns out to be my character and my version of Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah, it's so great. These fears are so visceral. I mean, I think there's so much stuff you can mine from anybody's childhood because, you know, it's a time of life. Then we didn't have language yet, and you didn't have the kind of construct to put all of these huge emotions that you were experiencing for the first time. And so these fairy tales, they really dig deep, I think, into people's fears.
Yeah, they do the job for you. Yeah. Although, you know, I think as I noted in my author's introduction, you know, there were real fears, you know, that these tales address. Like, you know, getting lost in the woods, you know, that, I mean, you know, you can still do that nowadays, but that was probably a much more present fear, prehistoric days, or getting eaten by an animal. You know, that doesn't happen nearly as often as it used to.
Though a great metaphor. I feel lost in the woods every day.
yeah. Well, you live in Southern California, of course. You're lost on the freeways.
Exactly. I think one of the other things that's great to study about your work that's hard for some writers is the details and finding the telling details from the random details. And every detail you put in, it feels so imbued with other stuff behind it. And I was wondering if you had any advice for writers on finding the right details.
You know, I guess the only thing I would say is to try and be economical. Yeah, and telling that it really, yeah, you can always report or invent a great amount of detail. You know, his favorite color was green, and he was born in July, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Mike will probably recognize some of my old tired lectures on this. But you know, what is it that is you know, the sharpest detail, or the most unusual, or the one that suggests the kind of lens through which you're seeing a character. You know, what is it that informs us about the way that we're meant to view them, rather than just reporting? And, you know, I guess the other thing that comes with detail, and detail is a good way to think of description, because description is always that slower element. It's the thing that can, you know, well, slow a narrative and you know, also bog it down if you're not careful. So, you know, just one or two telling details. You know, you don't have to give a police sketch of a character or a setting or anything else. You know, if you can pick the right, you know, kind of, I suppose unusual detail, the one that will get a reader's attention. So I would go for economy. I would go for less being more.
Yeah.
You know, when you're putting together some kind of descriptive passage.
Right, right. Yeah, find the weird. You're wonderful
yeah.
at finding the weird.
Find the weird. I like that. I'm going to put that on a bumper sticker.
I guess sort of related to that is dealing with a data dump of information when a writer feels like they have to convey, you know, it's the old show, not don't tell, but but conveying a lot of information about a world in a natural way through detail and through description rather than...
Yeah, well, through exposition also. I think that's what you're talking about. And again, it's kind of the what do we need to know and when do we need to know it? Sometimes, pardon me, sometimes it's nice to withhold information until a story gets going. I don't mean the kind of cheap trick like at the end you find out somebody is a dwarf or, you know, something like that. You've been reading them all along and you didn't know that they were an alien from another planet. That's fun too. That's like episodes of Twilight Zone, I suppose. But you don't have to lay it all out in the beginning. Things can gradually emerge. I just started a story which has yet to quite get off the ground, so it may die a morning, I don't know, but it's an older couple that are just kind of bumbling around the house, not in very good shape, but I think I want their house to be just full of kind of alarming incidents of decrepitude, which do not always have to be, spelled out right away, because these people, this is the way they live.
Right.
They don't notice that, they're keeping all their financial records in the oven. And, it makes perfect sense to them, or the laundry hasn't been done, they just throw it down the chute, or whatever. I haven't even, finished imagining it yet. But I think there's, it's what they call in fashion the reveal. You take off the cloak and there's a whole other ensemble underneath it. I think it can be not even just for purposes of surprise or suspense, but just so as not to overwhelm a reader with, laying out, all of the what, who, what, where, and how at the beginning. And of course, some stories seem to be, or narratives seem to be set in very recognizable worlds. They don't need a great deal of explanation. Somebody's at, the grocery store in the early 21st century in a major metropolitan American, locale. You don't need a whole great deal of exposition. But if you're going to set it in some place or time that is, less familiar to your audience, then you have to work a little harder
at
filling in setting and telling us where we are.
So going back to the story that you're just getting off the ground now, how much do you feel, maybe at the stage the story is at right now, is your subconscious doing the work for you and you just following along whatever, kind of kernels come out of
you? Oh, my subconscious is very lazy. it needs to be goaded and kicked in the butt and, bribed and threatened. If your subconscious did everything for you, wouldn't it be easy? You could wake up in the morning and write down your dreams. No, it's pretty conscious. There may be a point, pardon me, after you've gotten a good deal of it down on paper that you step back and say, oh, I see what's really at work here. This hand is really a fist, and is propelling things this way or that way, or this is what I was really writing about, all along. But, now there's a great deal droid work, sentence by sentence, word by word, building a structure. And then maybe you can step back and say, aha, I see the patterns.
Yeah.
So, no, the subconscious doesn't do it for me. I mean, you can't get rid of it, but, it's not the one that has to sit down at the, at the page and get the words done.
Damn it. I was hoping for a different answer there, but yeah.
Oh, you wanted it to be easy.
I wanted it to be easy. I was looking for the wormhole.
If it was easy, everybody could do it. Or if we all had just fabulous, well-tuned subconscious gifts.
That'd be great.
It's like doing the damned laundry. You don't always feel like doing it. You just got to get up and get it done.
Yeah. To your earlier point about whether or not you know it's going to work as a story? Is there a point where you know that a project should be abandoned, that it's just not going anywhere?
Yeah. And I think that's part of just, you know, learning your craft is learning where, you know, something is, you know, where you're up against a wall. You know, this was a nice idea. It's not working out. I will put it in a folder, which I reserve for those nice ideas that didn't work out, and maybe I can, you know, thriftily use it, you know, somewhere else. But yeah, and really that's just part of learning your own energy and your own, you know, ways of going about writing. You know, that's part of practice, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. My guest this morning is Jean Thompson. She's written a host of things. Most recently was the last one that came out was The Witch and Other Tales Retold. Yes. I think that was the most recent.
Yes. And could I tell you about the one that's coming up next?
Oh, God, please. Yes. Yes.
Yes. It's a novel. It will be out in June from Blue Rider Press Penguin, and it's called She Poured Out Her Heart. She poured out her heart. Not she poured her heart out, by the way. She poured out her heart.
Oh.
So that's coming up in June. And that is a novel that, you know, deals with a long-term friendship between two women, two very different women. And the epigraph, if they'll let me use it, and I think they are, I don't think I have to pay for it, is from the Steve Winwood song, you know, think about it, there must be higher love, because these are characters who, you know, have to deal with love, what is love, and where does it all take us, and how do we fight our way through it, and what sense does it make, you know, so I don't want to make it sound too much like a you know, girls' magazine or anything, but that's the structure of it, and that's the theme, and that'll be out in June, She Poured Out Her Heart.
I'll get to have you back on. That's great. That's great.
Thank you.
You are a lover of songs and music. I know the Who Do You Love started out with a song lyrics, and
yeah,
some of the titles were
from Bo Diddley. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about sort of the intersection of music and writing for you, and how you use music in your work.
Oh, you know, not constantly, honestly. I have in some of these occasions. And you know, sometimes there's songs that, you know, do seem to call forth, you know, or music that grabs you, and you kind of say, if only I could write a book that went along with, you know, but it's more serendipitous than anything, you know, so, but yeah, the Who Do You Love, you know, it's such a, you know, I don't know if everybody knows this song now, but it's really, you know, kind of a threatening,
yeah,
you know, sort of lyric. You know, I walk 47 miles of barbed wire, wear a cobra snake for a necktie, you know. You know, come on and take a little walk and tell me who do you love. You know, I love the guy. I've got a brand new house with a chimney on top, chimney made of a human skull, you know. I mean,
yeah.
It's not a sugary, you know, kind of version of love. So I think that, you know, of course, perversely, you know, that's what appealed to me.
Me too. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's all that subversive danger lurking in the background stuff that I love of yours. I think it's.
Yeah, and you know, but I live such an ordinary, quiet life, honestly. You know, there's nothing very dangerous going on in these four walls these days. But
it's got to come out somewhere,
know,
right?
imagination can help you with that.
Right. We've all got the dark side. You just have to figure out how to let it out. So that's good.
You got to work on it. You got to develop that dark side.
Exactly. So I had heard that you worked with immigrant and migrant workers. I don't know if you still do that, but that you had done that. And I was thinking, you know, of kind of the different ways that writers can live in the world to hear other people's stories. I thought that was a really great way.
Oh, well, you know, there have been some episodes where I have tutored Latino immigrants. You know, I actually lived in California for a time and did it there, and then I've done it through a program here that's no longer active. And I am not bilingual or anything close to it, but I'm very interested in the way language, you know, it communicates, and it also creates barriers. And certainly that's you know, the thing you're trying to do is, you know, tell me your story. Tell me what you want to tell me. So there was something that, just appealed to me, just to be helpful and to be helping people with their daily tasks and, you know, to get through our world when they needed to have this tool of language. But also, you know, how can you find somebody else's story? How can you learn somebody else's narrative? By accessing language, by reaching. I mean, I've sat down with people where I'm trying to talk in my wretched Spanish and they're trying to talk in their inadequate English, and we're trying to understand each other, and that's just, an interesting exercise, if nothing else.
Absolutely, absolutely. Are there other ways that you sort of live in the world as a writer, like, taking notes on people's dialogue or what you pay attention to?
You'd better not. That's a good way to get smacked upside the head. Excuse me, would you say something else in your colorful Argo, so that I can exploit your speech? I think you have to be, I think you have to notice. I think you have to have a certain curiosity. I think you have to have an ear for what people say, and little fragments of language will stick with you, and if you have access to people whose speeches, whose speech and speech patterns are different than your own, I think you pay more attention to, I've had people who, I'm thinking of an old neighbor of mine who was talking about somebody and said, "She's just as rough as a cob, ain't she? She's rough as a cob." I love that. I think a writer's ear picks up on things that are fresh and different, and hopefully you don't have to write them down or whip out your phone and make a voice memo. I think that would be, kind of a wretched thing to do. But hopefully you remember them.
I guess if they're worth remembering, you'll remember them, and then you don't
have
to worry about it.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you've made my day by telling me that there's a book coming in June. I didn't know that.
Well,
that's
fantastic. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for reading, all of these previous books, and thanks to Mike for, obviously, for showcasing me. So it's his turn next, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it is his turn next. It is. Well, thanks for writing it all, because it's been a well of great information. Is there anything else we should have talked about that we didn't? Any advice that you give out?
No. I think we've been very comprehensive. So I thank you for your questions and your interest.
This was a treat. Thanks so much, Jean.
Thanks, Mari.
That was Jean Thompson, and a new book is coming out in June, and she's got six collections of short stories, six novels. So whatever your interest in short story or the novel form, Jean has you covered. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Mike Chizniewski is going to be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. There are information on past shows. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of interviews up there from the past 18 years of this show. We broadcast what is coming up. We broadcast speaker series events and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I gave a little introduction as to how today's show came about, but I am very excited to be now with Michael Chizniewski. He is the author most recently of I Will Love You for the Rest of My Life, as well as two more collections of stories, Elephants in Our Bedroom and Chicago Stories, 40 Dramatic Fictions. In 2010, he received a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship for his fiction. He is an assistant professor at Missouri State University and managing editor of Moon City Review. He lives in Springfield, Missouri, and he has agreed to come on this morning. Mike, welcome.
Oh, hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. This is super fun. I'm really glad we're doing this today. It's The wonders of Facebook. I was thanking Mark Zuckerberg for bringing us together and introducing me to your awesome blog. And so before we dive in, there's
did
so
Mark
much.
Did Mark talk to you personally? Did he write me?
Mark Zuckerberg. It's amazing how much Mark knows about what I would like to buy and who I would like to talk to and what I'd like to listen to. So he did sort of, in a way, serve you up to me that way, which worked out. So tell us about the blog project.
Good. I'm glad he's a follower.
Yeah, I know he's a big fan of yours. So tell me about Story 366 and kind of how it got off the ground and what you were thinking about when you created it and kind of how it works.
Story 366 was supposed to be Story 365 because I wanted to do it last year, where I take a short story that I've never read before and read it and then write a little response, kind of mini essay about it online in the form of a blog so people can just kind of know about the story and even more so know about the author, know about a new book or an old book that they have coming out. It's really modeled after what a guy named Dan Wickett does with the Emerging Writers Network. Dan is stationed outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Dan, along with publisher Steve Gillis, formed Zank Books, who published my first book. And before I had any kind of book or book contract with them, Dan had featured a couple of my stories on his Emerging Writers Network blog, and I, you know, had a little exposure that way, and then he kind of got into my book from there, and that's how I got my first book out. But I was really inspired that he just showcased different writers, and I learned a lot about a lot of writers I'd never heard of before from that blog, and I'd wanted to do it. In fact, later on, I'd done some guest posting on Emerging Writers Network forum, especially during Short Story Month, which I believe is May.
Uh-huh.
That sounds right.
Uh-huh.
That we would be on the Tales of Poetry Month in April, but so I wanted to do it, and finally I think I just got to the point where I wanted to, and I almost did it last year and then didn't get it started. So since we have 366 days this year, it is now Story 366.
You have to do an extra
one. And so far I have 27 up and 27 down. I've not faltered yet in 27 days.
Which has totally impressed me. Every day I'm like, yep, he did it again. That's great. So tell me a little bit about how you choose the stories, and are they all, they're all kind of new to you, right?
Right. I've never read any story before. I didn't know if I was going to do that or not. Like, I thought I might do stories that are just classics, or maybe I would have Classic Wednesday and mm-hmm. just talk about, like, A Good Man is Hard to Find or The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. But then that's just not really what I wanted to do, and I wasn't going to learn as much from that. And it's been really fun to just do a new story and a new author. It's getting me reading new things. I just have these hundreds of books around my house that I've never opened before.
Yeah.
And this has been a really nice way for me to be, hey, I've looked at that book on my shelf. I've looked at the spine. I've looked at the cover. I really need to get to this book and see what it's about. I bought it, after all. And, you know, in a lot of cases, the author signed it for me. And that's what I wanted to do. So I've decided it was going to be new stories. Every day.
I love it. I've got so many of those collections too. And actually, some of the stories that you've posted are collections I have laying around the house that I'm like, all right, I'll read that story now. So it's a good thing. So let's talk a little bit about your book. I Will Love Her for the Rest of My Life came out last year. And so tell me a little bit about, it's a lot of flash fiction, which I am a huge fan of. Not all of it is, but a lot of it is. It allows you to do some really experimental, interesting, different things, which I think are really fun. So tell me a little bit about the origins of that book and how it came together.
This book became about because I really wanted to write a book. I had published Chicago Stories a couple years beforehand, and here I was, and I wasn't really having a lot of direction on a project. And because I'm an assistant professor and they want you to do things like publish books in order to keep you there, you know, that kind of amps up your schedule, which is good because it makes you do things like write and have projects and be focused. So it was around 2012, and I hadn't had a book out in a couple of years, or since I'd been hired here. So I started looking and seeing what I'd written. I had a novel going that wasn't going very far. You know, Gene talks about end of chapters where it says, and then he pondered for a while, and that's kind of where my novel was around page 50, where I had a character on the L in Chicago, riding around the L, just thinking about things and looking at the city, and that's kind of where that ended. So the novel wasn't really going anywhere except driving around in circles around the loop and stuff. So I went to my stories that I'd written, and I looked at a lot of them, the ones that hadn't been in books yet or stories that were new, and they had this theme, and they were about relationships falling apart, relationships that had fallen apart. So I did a page count and did a story count and said, you know what, I think I can do this book. I can do a book that has this central theme in it and be really focused. And I pitched it to my press, Curbside Splendor, and within a day or two, they had written back and said, yeah, we'd be interested in publishing a book like that. So I set off on finishing it. I wrote probably, I'd say, 40% of it I had to write yet. Oh. I wrote with that in mind, like, I have to write breakup stories. I have to write these stories where things don't turn out well for people who are in love.
Was it easier to write the stories once you knew the theme, or did the other ones come easier? Like, once you knew what your task was, did it oppress you, or did it give you freedom?
I think both. The stories that I wrote after I had the book kind of approved and accepted are the longer stories in the book. And when I mean longer, I think there's one story that's 12 pages, and that's kind of the big, you know, story with gigantism in that book. And then there's like a 9-page story and a couple 7-page stories. Those were the longer stories in the book. I tried to make them shorts and put a 1,000-word limit, then a 1,500-word limit. Then I'm like, well, I can do 2,000 words. People might still consider those short because I wanted the book to be all shorts, but then they weren't. So I don't think they were harder to write, but when I had this real goal in mind where I'm like, well, this has to lead up to these people not staying together, I think that made me write longer for whatever reason. Like when I was writing the shorts and I didn't know what I was doing, I'm like, okay, well, I'll just end it. And they went their separate ways and were sad. The end.
I like it. You know, there are a lot of allergies in this book. A lot of people had allergies, and I was thinking that's kind of a really interesting physical manifestation of breakups, you know, that sort of the body rebelling against something within the way, you know, your heart sort of rebels against love. You know, I just thought it was really kind of a nice metaphor that was just sprinkled throughout a few of the stories that just, I don't know, came to my attention.
Oh, wow. It doesn't only work as a metaphor. It was just such an intentional metaphor that I certainly knew about when I wrote about them and always talked about. Actually, no, I've never heard that before. I know there's the story with the peanut allergy, the pregnant with peanut butter story about the epinephrine and stuff like that. And
yeah, I want to talk about that one. I really like that.
I hadn't noticed the allergies. I have allergies, so maybe it's just part of my subconscious.
I think it was also in the plum story. There were a couple of different allergies. I counted three of them. I think one was in the plum story. I can't remember exactly where they were, but
oh, yeah, you're right. That's at least another one. Well, if there's three, that means it's a conspiracy. So,
right? So let's talk a little bit about the peanut butter one. For those people that haven't read it, it's called Pregnant with Peanut Butter, I think, is my memory of that. And
so
you can kind of tell us what it's about, and then I'm going to ask you an artful question about it, perhaps.
Well, it's a story about a guy with a really bad peanut allergy that needs to carry epinephrine around and with him, and his pharmacist, who is this very beautiful, demure, sexy woman, kind of has this plan because she's the one that has to refill his injectors. And she has this plan, and she's kind of going the route that she's wondering if it would have the same effect, peanut butter on this guy, the same effect as autoerotic asphyxiation. So she kind of, like, uses him as a guinea pig, as a sexual guinea pig. And all this takes place over, like, about 3 pages. So I was inspired. I was thinking about that for whatever reason after David Carradine died, and I had heard how he had died.
Kind of
accidentally killed himself. And for some reason, that inspired me to take that in a different direction. So
I love it.
That's a fun story. That's a good out loud story. I read that at readings, and I almost won literary death match with that story, but I got killed in the trivia question at the end,
the
trivia contest at the end. But yeah, I was that's a good out loud story.
That is a good out loud story. Well, the reason that I was going to bring it up is there's a flashback scene in that story where he flashes back to a memory of being briefly kidnapped, that was kind of an aborted kidnap that didn't quite work out. That seemed to make such sense with the rest of the story, but for reasons that that are kind of hard to articulate. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about, I don't know, like what it is in a character's backstory that can inform the forward momentum of a story. And when you know the backstory is working, but not so obvious as with kind of how that backstory came about.
That backstory is about a kid who, he's on his way to school and some guy grabs him and throws him in a van. The origin of that is I'm the same age as Adam Walsh, John Walsh's kid that was kidnapped and murdered in Florida. And when that Adam Walsh story happened and was happening in the news, I was, 8, 9, 10 years old, and there was just this really scary time to be a kid because at school we had these police officers. Officer Friendly came and talked a lot about that, and all our teachers talked about being safe and being just like watching out for strangers. And there was just this real terror. I mean, as much as we were doing air raid sirens and sitting under our desks once a month because we thought the Russians were going to drop nuclear bombs on our school, and our desks were going to save us, of course, from that. There was also just this very fearful time of being a kid and someone just snatching you and doing awful things to you.
Yeah.
And so I walked around. I walked around with my parents, and when we went to, like, a store somewhere or, a shopping center, I just grasped onto my parents' leg, like, for dear life, because every person, the way they were telling it at school, every person was going to snatch me and throw me in a van, and my parents would never see me again. How I lived for about a year and a half when I was a kid, because people told me that was going to happen. So I wanted to get that into a story somewhere, and that just made sense because the character in the peanut butter story doesn't trust people. He has these trust issues, and he's afraid of the world. And we find out near the end of the story that his backstory is that this had happened to him, that he'd been kidnapped and came really, really close to being, dismembered. Okay. Except he's kind of saved by circumstance. But so that's how that happened. But, yeah, backstories, if they're not too obvious, can be, they're informative. I've actually read that story without the backstory part, and it's still kind of funny, but it doesn't make as much sense.
Yeah, right.
But I think it's better with the backstory. I think, when I did Literary Deathmatch, you only have so much time. So I just, what do I cut? I want to read this. I'll just cut the backstory out. And it still works in that venue, but I think on paper it works better with the backstory.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a nice note to people who write flash fiction that just because it's short doesn't mean that you can, still means that you can, have fully fleshed out characters that, have history and all that. So I just thought it was a good instructive story on how to seamlessly weave in character information in sort of a non-obvious but makes everything feel fuller and more understandable way. It was really nice.
Something I do just for fun sometimes is I have done this in stories before and it works out and sometimes it doesn't. And I'll just throw a backstory sequence in like that, and I don't really know what it has to do with anything. I just have another narrative that seems kind of interesting. And I'm like, well, I'll just fuse these two stories together and see what happens. And what happens is that some readers start reading into it. I mean, people who read short stories, they're trained to look for things like that and to try to find the meaning behind things. And I see my students do it all the time, where every sentence and every object is a metaphor. It's like, oh, why was his shirt blue? Is he sad? I'm like, well, no, maybe he's just wearing a blue shirt that day. But
maybe he just has allergies.
Kind of find things. So I kind of play with that. I'm like, I'm going to put two completely unrelated things together. One is the main story and one is the backstory. And sure enough, people come up with things. It's like your interpretation of the allergies, where you know, they say like, oh yeah, that's really smart. Like, wow, that's a great metaphor. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's what I was thinking when I wrote that.
Just take the credit. I think that's the best answer.
No, yeah, just deny everything and just nod. That's how I work.
Yeah. And another way that I heard how you work that I'm going to start employing is the 6 month drawer rule, I'm calling it. So you put your work away in a drawer for 6 months, and that's when it's allowed to come out. And then you can kind of be your own critique group in that way, because the story has had time to separate from your own mind and you can see it fresh and new. I think that's probably a good technique for short story writers or any writer.
Yeah, I think when you're writing stories, you're not in any hurry to write them. Where you're trying to compile a collection eventually, but you don't need to send your story. I mean, that's a mistake I made in grad school. Is like the second that I typed the last word of a story, I was printing it out and sending it out in the mail. And like, oh, you know, another victory here, and better get this out so somebody can publish it for me. And you know, none of those stories got published. You don't do that. I read an interview with Kentucky writer Chris Offit, who actually, he's the one that said that 6 month rule, where he throws something in a drawer for 6 months and works on other things, and he actually dates things in folders and file folders in his drawer, and he won't get back to it. It's almost like an amaryllis bulb, where you're supposed to write the date that you cut off the stalk and put it in your drawer, so you know that it's time to pull it out and let it replant it again. And then I think that's what you have to do with stories, because you're never going to figure out what they're about until you let them sit for a while. And then sometimes in the middle of that 6 months, I'll be like just walking down the sidewalk or taking a shower, and I'll think about it for some reason, and I'll get an idea for it, and I'll make sure I'll go like scribble it down.
Yeah.
So that just happens, and if you don't give yourself that time, you're never going to have those moments of revelation.
Right. My guest this morning is Michael Chizniewski. The book, most recent book, is I Will Love You for the Rest of My Life. And I want to talk a little bit about living in the world as a writer and where you get all your kind of writerly toolbox of curiosities. And I know that you hawk beer at Wrigley Field, which I think is kind of the most awesome job ever, besides being a writer, I guess. You've got the two most awesome jobs ever.
I think it's good. I guess I should probably throw in like actually playing for the Cubs would be better, because I thought that was what I was going to do until I was about 13 or 14 and realized I am not athletically gifted in any way to be a professional baseball player. But up till I was about 13, I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, like I'll play for the Cubs. And then after that, I'll, you know, just live in my mansion and, you know, watch TV. But
it's a lot of pressure.
But in terms of like jobs, like working at Wrigley Field and, you know, getting to sell beer, and that's been a lot of fun. So,
and I know at least one of the stories had a baseball, you know, the baseball game that never ended. It was in like 42 innings or something. But I was wondering which was funny. I was wondering if there were other things that kind of come out of your, I don't know. Do you do that job just purely for fun, or I mean, it seems like it'd be a great source of material beyond just baseball, but it's just like a great source of like, I don't know, seeing how people interact when they're so fanatical about a sport, or seeing how they interact when they've been drinking, or seeing, I don't know, just weird stuff happens at baseball games that I thought would make kind of good fodder for writers.
Oh, yeah. It's just great to get into Chicago. Going and doing that job every summer, it's fun. I like getting to Chicago. I like the Cubs. I watch every Cub game anyway. From beginning to end, there's 162 games. I probably watch 155 of them.
Oh my God.
From beginning to end anyway. So it's kind of surreal when I'm there. I'm like, oh, I would normally be listening to this on the radio or watching it on my computer, but here I am actually at the game right now. So that's something. This is my 27th year coming up at Wrigley Field, and
oh, wow.
I've never taken that for granted that I get to be at Wrigley Field for free. And, in fact, they pay me to go there, so that's really nice. It's inspiring to be in Chicago or to be in any environment. I've lived in Missouri now, in kind of rural southwest Missouri, for a long time now. And, you know, you get kind of used to that after a while and what Springfield, Missouri is. And being in Chicago is just kind of really exhilarating in a way. Or even, you know, or going anywhere else, like any new place can do for you. Yeah, it's been really fun. Like, I'm not really overhearing people and, like, getting stories when my last book came out, the Chicago Stories, the one that's about that this is made up of monologues of Chicagoans. I did an interview about that, and somebody asked me about the Wrigley job, and the interviewer wanted to know, it's like, well, have you heard about all these stories when you were vending?
Yeah.
Selling beer at Wrigley Field? Did you overhear? Is that where you get your stories? I'm like, oh, no, I mean, I really like being at Wrigley Field. But she's like, but you get your, she was not even asking me at a point. She was telling me, you get your ideas. You're listening in when you're pouring somebody a beer to what they're talking about, and that's where you get your ideas, right? And I just had to say no, but, like, she wasn't really grasping onto the idea that I made up my stories, and that was just kind of ancillary. So she was really convinced, because that was the angle she wanted, that I was this kind of, like, person who was this, you know, auditory peeping Tom who just listened to people say things and, aha, you know, there's my next story, is the people who are talking about, you know, whatever was going on in their life. And, you know, sometimes I think that might happen, but not on a conscious level.
Yeah.
I don't go up and down the aisles looking for my next story idea, hoping that somebody, like, you know, cheated on their wife or, you know.
It's going to get caught on the kiss cam.
Right. Right.
There's some Vegas thing about the kiss cams, and, you know, and because it's Vegas, people are, like, running in opposite directions when their faces come up on the kiss cams because they're not there with who they're supposed to be with. But anyway, that's another story for another time. My guest this morning is Michael Chizniewski. We're running down on time, but there are a couple of last craft questions that I want to ask you, because you're so great at titles. Titles are super hard, I think, for short story writers, and now you had to come up with, you know, 29 of them or 30 of them or something. Tell me about getting titles right and kind of the work of the title, of especially flash fiction, where you just, you know, every word counts for so much.
Yeah, titles are hard. I mean, some, you know, there's different ways to go about it. You can pick a line from the story, and that works sometimes. You can use a word that has nothing to do with anything. Like, you know, I knew people who just, like, they would write their stories and they would just write the silliest title they could have. They're like, they would put something on, like, you know, Avocado Euphoria, and that was just the name of the story about people, you know, people talking to each other. It had nothing to do with anything. I've never done that. I think titles come to you as you go along. I don't, you know, hit center on my Microsoft Word document, type a title, and then go over to Left Justify and start writing the story. I always do what I can to just, like, come up with that as a story. That's one of those things, like, you're either working on the story or, you know, like I said, you just worked on the story and you're walking to class or you're walking to the grocery store, and it comes to you, like, in a moment where you're not really thinking about it.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of my titles, that's where the title of the book came from, is I didn't know what it was going to be, because, like, we were kicking around just calling it breakup stories, and that seemed so generic. So instead I went to the ironic long title, I Will Love You for the Rest of My Life, just this ridiculous statement that seems so empty and unpromisable. And then, but I'm like, but if we have breakup stories as the subtitle, then it'll be kind of a joke and be kind of funny, and I think it works better like that. But yeah, I think a lot of my titles come later. It's hard, because then when you have something like a one-word title, I think that carries a lot of responsibility with the title to do it. So you have to think about that automatically that word becomes a metaphor and a theme. So you have to be careful with one-word titles. And yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways to do that, but they're really important no matter what way you come up with them.
The Pregnant with Peanut Butter I liked because it was actually the beginning of the story. I mean, it was kind of the, you know, I mean, it took me a beat to figure out that Pregnant with Peanut Butter was the start of the story. Like, you had to read that into it to understand what was going to come next. And I hadn't seen a title that had done that I thought was really, I don't know, clever and economical.
Oh, I steal that from poets. Poets do that all the time, where the title of their poem leads into the, like, really the first line of their poem and leads in.
Yeah, that's
like
great.
Leads into the rest of the story. Like, you have to read it like that. That's like some journals, they'll put the author's name between the title and the first line and you know, in the paragraph. And I'd done that with a magazine, and I had a title like that led into the story. And I'm like, your format doesn't work for me.
Right.
Because they can't read the title, then read my name, and then read the rest of the first sentence, because it doesn't make sense all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So I actually think I got that magazine to change their format and how they did their page layout to put the author's name on top of the titles from then on. So,
I love it.
But that's my great contribution to literature, as I made a magazine where they put the author's name on the first page.
Which is a good one. Which is good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, if that's what I'm known for, then so be it.
Well, you're really known for your short story blog, and I want to plug that one more time. We're running out of time, but Story 366 is the blog, and Michael Chizniewski, this is fantastic. And we can find you. I mean, you're all over Facebook, obviously, because that's how I found you. Are there other ways that people can find you or maybe you don't want to be found, and I shouldn't say this.
No, I want to be found. I want people to look at my blog, and I want them to read it and, you know, get hits, and I want them to write comments, and I want them to send me suggestions for books, and want them to send me their books so I can talk about them. I have all these books piled up on my dining room table because that's where I do my work, and there's like 100 short story collections and literary magazines piled up there. And I think, like, wow, how am I going to get to all these? And I'm like, oh, wait, I have another 335 to go. I'm not going to have a problem. So I'm sooner or later going to, like, run out. And my wife describes it as I have a $10-a-day habit of short stories where I keep ordering these books on Amazon, and I'm going to run out of money soon. So, no, I want people to, you know, come up with ideas and, you know, give me links to things. So I want people to go there.
It's awesome because I feel like the short story for so long had kind of played the ugly stepchild to the novel, and it just seems like they're collection after collection. So it just is enjoying a wonderful, well-deserved renaissance, it seems like. Many thanks to you for doing this project and keeping the short story, exposing so many new great writers to the world. It's a great project.
Oh, it's so much fun. I get to do that, and maybe next year I'll get really ambitious and I'll do novel 365 and read a novel a day.
Ooh, there
but
you go.
Probably not.
Probably not. Maybe
if I start using speed heavily, I can do that. But probably not otherwise.
Maybe just poetry 365. Michael,
poem 365. Somebody's going to do it, and I'm just going to write them, and I'm going to be like, really?
Your wife can do that.
I should have my wife. I tried to talk her into that. Actually, it's funny you said that, but she's like, so every day, 366 days?
No.
But she actually has a great blog that I love anyway, that people should go to.
Yes, so. She does have a great blog. Can you say that really fast? We got to go.
It's called Better View of the Moon, and it's by Karen Crago.
Awesome.
She's pretty awesome.
She is very awesome. Michael Chizniewski, thank you so much for taking the time. This was great.
Thanks, Marie. I had fun.
All right. That is all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.